Are you enjoying this podcast? Well, you have KUOW members to thank for that. KUOW members make the trusted local journalism and storytelling you hear on this show possible. Become a member today and help support the production of this podcast. It only takes a minute. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you along with us. We figure out what happened this week. We discuss from different viewpoints. I've invited some excellent folks to spend some time with you. Seattle Times editorial board writer Claudia Rowe. Welcome back, Claudia.
Thanks for having me back.
We have writer and editor Sarah Ann Lloyd. Sarah, it's great to have you on the show.
Yes, absolutely.
Current real estate investor, but former Washington State legislator, Bill Finkbeiner. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Bill.
And you can watch the show on YouTube. Well, you guys can't. You have to focus on the radio show. But everyone else can watch you because we are on YouTube, streaming live. Just search KUOW Public Radio. Let us begin this week with how we teach our children. Book banning is at an all-time high nationwide. Our state legislature is in session. Democrats are supporting a bill to limit these book challenges. KUOW education reporter Sam U.S. told us this bill would prohibit schools from banning books just because they're written by or about marginalized groups like people of color and the LGBTQ community.
Senator Twyna Nobles and other Democrats say the bill will help keep diverse and inclusive books in public schools.
I believe every child deserves to encounter characters and stories that resonate with their own experiences, their own background and identity.
But ahead of the vote, Republicans like Senator Ann Rivers called the bill an overreach.
This bill truly represents the fact that the legislature is slowly moving school boards towards extinction.
Okay, so there's a little hint there. Legislature, state level, school boards, local level. One more thing I want to add before we discuss this. There's another bill in Olympia that would require the inclusion of histories, contributions, and perspectives of LGBTQ people in age-appropriate school curricula. School boards would have to adopt curricula covering such groups as Native Americans, Hispanic Americans, people of different religions, and people who are neurodiverse. So, we were talking about this before the show started. On social media, this boils down to you are imposing degenerate values on children, or you're a puritanical, mind-controlling bigot. And that's not really the big picture. What's going on here? Bill Finkbeiner, you told me you think this is more about a grown-up fight than really children's education.
Yeah, that's the way it feels to me. It's almost like, isn't this sort of an argument that happened maybe like 60 years ago? I mean, really, book banning at this point in time to try to, get a bunch of folks all stirred up about that just feels like in this world where so much media and information is open to really fight about, fight to ban books feels like the cows are gone. You're trying to close the barn door.
Well, let me ask you. You were a Republican state representative and senator, right?
State senator, yeah.
State senator. Were you more in touch, more in line with your Republican Party when you served than you would be today?
I definitely was more when I served. But even then, I had a lot of differences of opinion, especially on issues like this. We had a music ban that came before the legislature when I was there. And that's what this feels a little bit to me like. And I always thought the ironic thing about that, too, is, you do a music ban or a book ban. And really, generally, what you're doing is bumping the sales of that music or the books that you're trying to ban. Mm-hmm. So it does feel like an anachronism. It feels like an argument we had in the 90s as opposed to one that is appropriate for today.
Or you could say it's kind of a cynical move because the people who are pushing for these bans surely know that. They surely know this increases sales, interest, desirability of the banned object or book or film or music. Mm-hmm. So there maybe is another reason for pushing this kind of thing.
And that reason would be?
Packing school boards with people who might want things like vouchers. Other reasons, other larger reasons that affect more people than books.
I mean, there is the larger cultural context of now versus 40 years ago, which is that we have, I mean, this feels like the libs of TikTok bill, right? Where there is a social media account of a conservative, I would say like more than conservative woman. She's like very far right, taking liberal social media posts, especially from teachers, and posting them on Twitter with commentary. And it's very, it has a history of leading to a lot of complaints to school boards and to individual schools and against teachers from people that have no horse in the race. For example, I mean, one thing that I brought up when we were talking earlier is, I mean, it's a fight between adults. I 100% agree with that. But kids do really tragically get caught in the middle of this. There was one teacher that was targeted by libs of TikTok that ended up basically being forced to resign for stating support for queer students. And then a kid at that very school was killed in the bathroom after they had specifically kept kids from using gender-affirming bathrooms.
Okay, well, let me ask you about this because I didn't know before you told me about it, about libs of TikTok. And we've brought up sort of hidden agendas. But to the issue of whether and when to ban a book from curriculum or from a school library, we were talking before the show that there are legitimate concerns about, who decides, but like understandable concerns about what is age appropriate, what is fine for an older kid, not a younger kid. Sometimes that gets into enforcing the norms we like or the norms other people like. Then there's the question of who gets to decide. Is it the state? Is it at the local level? And we sometimes switch on that equation. Sometimes people want federal control when they want federal control, or state or local. So how do we live together in Washington State on this issue?
I think one thing we're kind of all saying is that this feels like it's a political thing as opposed to an education thing. This feels like the politicization of our school boards, where it's become less about how to educate kids, the discussion, and it feels like the people that are pushing for the book ban are just looking for something salacious that they can do to, you know, get a foot in the door to try to get folks that they want elected to the school board, as opposed to showing up to the school board because they're concerned about students and they're concerned about education. And it's really, you know, I think the thing we can do is try to look at issues that affect kids' education, affect their safety in the schools, and affect the education that's happening, as opposed to, what feels like to me kind of a diversion of, you know, adults arguing about something that really isn't going to impact, and especially the folks that are driving this, because it's clearly an agenda to try to get people elected to the school board by fomenting outrage about something that, you know, is in a library someplace.
Absolutely. And if it was really about education, many parents and many teachers would say, hey, whatever my kid is reading, if they're reading, that's better than scrolling, you know. And there are a lot of educators I've encountered throughout my life, not only as a journalist, who have said, whatever they're reading. That's the key. So that's what I mean. I think this is kind of a red herring.
I'm asking, how does thinking it's a red herring and suspecting their motives, very understandably, how does that get us toward a solution in our democracy? Does it mean that we just ignore, like, the questions, for example, of what's age appropriate? You know, that because probably they're just they have their own secret agenda. The way we're going to live together is not consider. We're never going to keep a because there's all kinds of compromises we could have. We could have, you specific parent, we'll give your kid something else to read.
Which is what the law says,
yeah.
Is what the law proposes. And that's fine. That's great.
Okay.
I mean, if these parents are saying it should be more about, you know, respecting what parents want, then great. You could talk about this troubling book at home with your kid, mm-hmm. or you could talk to the teacher and ask for a different book for your kid. Great. Then let's take these parents at their word and say, good, Then you talk to your child at home about what you see as problematic about this book. Engage in a conversation with your child. Great. Have it be at the parent level.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think this law is a really common sense kind of set of guidelines to just keep people that are being disingenuous about their motives from just wasting everybody's time so we can focus on those conversations in our school districts that are genuine concerns from parents. I am also in the camp of as long as they're reading, I love it. Kids have been finding age-inappropriate material since they were cave children, probably.
Yes.
But I like having these kind of this rubric in place for what we will actually entertain when we're focusing on educating our children.
Yeah. Well, we'll follow this through the legislature. It's generally along party lines at this point, but we'll see whether I know about two bills that I think are still alive, and we'll see whether those bills make it to the governor. Well, let's talk
about two bills.
Pardon me?
Those two bills.
We have two bills on the show. We have two.
Either one are going to the governor.
You got closer than I did, Fink Miner. So that's what kids are reading. Let's talk about how we know what kids have learned. Because, you know, the grades in Washington may not indicate how well a student is doing in school. Claudia, I read about this in the Seattle Times research out of Harvard and Stanford suggesting that test scores are flat or down, and yet grades are up because teachers are inflating those grades.
Yeah, they are. This certainly isn't a new thing. As we all know, this has gone on time immemorial, right? But I think the key graph in that Seattle Times story from earlier this week is that OSPI says that 70% of ninth graders passed all their classes in last year, in the 22-23 school year. Yet, the testing data doesn't look like they're all at grade level. So, what is that, right? And as a parent, you want to feel like when your kid brings home some kind of solid grade, that is a true reflection of what they know. But I think many parents feel increasingly that it is not a true reflection. And that is concerning.
So isn't that an argument for standardized, well, just testing? They either know it or they don't. When I know there's a lot of opposition to standardized tests.
I don't think standardized tests prove that a kid absolutely knows something or absolutely doesn't. Some kids are bad testers.
Yes.
But when there's a wild skew in the kid's grade and their test score, something's going on there. Something is off.
Well, but a grade is subjective. I mean, some teachers grade on a curve. There's one reason there's grade inflation, I think, is because when a kid gets a good grade, a high grade, think how many happy people there are. The kid's happy. The parents are happy. The school looks successful. Look at how high our grades are. So what about we as a culture? Are we implicated in encouraging grade inflation?
I think grades have always been subjective. I remember Mrs. Cook in seventh grade, and everybody that went to her class at least once a week got an A.
Really?
Yep. And she'd give us all a hug on the way out of class. And it was really nice. And I think that was the only A I got that year. And
how about hugs? I hope you got more than just from Mrs.
Cook. I don't remember that. Okay. But it's like, you know, I think there's always been a tremendous amount of subjectivity. And then other teachers obviously would grade, you know, really at a much higher standard.
Mm-hmm.
I think that standardized tests, there's no perfect way to measure what students are learning, but standardized tests are, I think, a much more objective measurement. And they can tell us important information about how our kids are doing. And to me, that was a big part of, you know, the articles that I read on this was how much students have fallen back on the standardized tests. Not that, you know, I'm less concerned if grade inflation is going up across the board. You know, maybe that gives less information to parents and teachers. But I think I'm more concerned if objectively students are doing worse in math and reading year over year and significantly worse since COVID, really. To me, that's a big red flag in this.
I went to a high school that had no grades.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm alive, which is great. Nova Project, it's still a Seattle public school.
It's over by Garfield.
over by Garfield. They used to tell a joke, how do you get a Nova kid to cross the street? You tell them they'll get credit for it. but it was 80% pass, no pass. And if you didn't complete the coursework in time, not always, but you could often just kind of keep doing the work until you finished, which is how and we kind of built a lot of our own classwork, too. And we were very well aware of the district rubrics and competencies. Like, I took a class for health credit where I put in the hours through something that did not give me all the competencies, but then I did projects afterwards to fulfill the stuff that we didn't cover. Mm-hmm. And it was like a women's group that I was in. And I mean, I think that that's also, I don't think it's sustainable on like a really grand scale because it requires so much individualized attention. Maybe we just, you know, the age-old need for more teachers. But there are other ways to do it. And, you know, we had pretty good test scores, at least at the time that I was there. I haven't looked at them recently, but yeah.
Yeah. So what are we supposed to do? What do we do?
To me, I think the big thing we should be looking at is what was the impact of our state's reaction to COVID on our students, and not to assign blame or, you know, dig it back up, but to try to find a way to do better if we get into this situation next time.
So our top priority is to plan for the next pandemic.
I think it's you have to have a plan in place, and it's not necessarily a pandemic. There's lots of reasons that we could decide that, you know, students, you know, we need to close schools for a period of time, and to look at what impact does that have on students, and how can we keep students and teachers safe. I mean, it's a huge, you know, we're looking at basically 5 months behind where students were before in Seattle, and almost a full year behind in Yakima and Auburn in reading and math. And that's a significant impact that those kids are going to be dealing with the rest of their lives. And I think also, along with looking back and figuring out how we do better, is figuring out maybe we owe those kids a little bit too. They bore the brunt of a really significant impact on their education, and maybe it is more tutoring, more teachers, more support for those kids that face that during COVID. Because to me, that really, I feel bad for them.
I think the first thing is honesty. Let us please be honest about the reality here, because not everyone is being honest about it. At the state education department, they say learning loss is a misnomer. Mm-hmm. It didn't really happen. I see wildly variant responses from different school districts. Seattle Public Schools, for instance, is not throwing in with intensive tutoring, which pretty much everyone across the country, including in Washington, D.C., at the state Department of Education, you know, high dosage tutoring is the way to get kids back on track, but not everyone's doing it. I don't think we're getting strong leadership in that direction from the state education department, because I think that there's a strong bias towards saying, it's good, just keep going, we'll just roll forward, we're all good. We're not all good. Mm-hmm. No.
Well, we have been tutoring you on the topic of grade inflation here on Week in Review. We're going to take a little break and come back. We're going to check in on policing in Seattle, a big concern for our listeners, and cover more stories of the week when we continue here on Week in Review. Don't go away.
This podcast is free, and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
You are probably listening, possibly watching on YouTube, KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I'm here with writer-editor Sarah Ann Lloyd. We've got former Republican state lawmaker Bill Finkbeiner, Seattle Times ed board writer Claudia Rowe. I know that Week in Review listeners are concerned about policing and public safety and crime. So we check in on Seattle police regularly. I think most of us know that Seattle officer Kevin Dave was speeding through a South Lake Union crosswalk last year on an emergency call. He was flashing his overhead lights and chirping his siren, and a woman named John V. Kandula was in the crosswalk, and Officer Dave crashed his cruiser into her and killed her. Well, this week, King County prosecutors said, after investigating, they've decided not to file felony criminal charges against Officer Dave. The Seattle City Attorney could still charge him with negligent driving, but at the county felony level, the county prosecutor said, quote, "We lack sufficient evidence under Washington state law to prove a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt." The family of the young woman said that they are shocked. They issued a statement, and the statement said that they are shocked and disappointed. How can you help listeners think about what happened and the justice or not of felony charging this officer?
I mean, there's no justice available here, right? Even if the accident was unavoidable, a person is dead that should not be dead. And there's no justice. And sometimes there just is no justice, which I hate. But the thing that, in terms of justice we can control, what frustrated me about this story is that his partner, who made really inflammatory remarks on a phone call with the head of the police union, has not been fired yet. And Police Chief Diaz has had a month to consider whether or not to fire him, and he is still not fired.
And this was not his partner in the cruiser, but a union rep who was discussing
right.
the case, I think the next day or very soon afterward.
Right.
What else about the charging decision?
I believe we're supposed to hear in early March regarding the union vice president and whether the chief is going to discipline or fire that person. To Sarah's point, there's no justice for a dead woman who shouldn't be dead. What is sort of floating around this story is the response of the police union, this kind of joking, cavalier, oh yeah, just write a check. What did he say? Something like she's of limited value. This is
the union official says that he was not being cavalier. The two of them were bitterly.
Gallows humor.
I'm telling you what this union official says. Mm-hmm. That people do laugh. There's a lot of different ways to laugh, and his claim is that this was a sardonic sort of take on what lawyers do, that they try to put a price on somebody's life and talk that down. So that I don't know what was in his head, but that's. Just before we say it was cavalier, not cavalier, that was his defense of himself. He wasn't presenting to anyone. He was accidentally recorded having this private conversation. But go
true,
on.
True, but it's consistent with many other things going on in
right.
the Seattle Police Department.
Where the interpretation comes
right.
from.
Right. I mean, it sort of perhaps it's unfortunate that it lines up with many indicators of a sort of general culture. Of you could call it contemptuousness, you could call it dismissiveness, lack of seriousness regarding the people that Seattle police are supposed to protect and serve.
Right.
And Mike Solon is, you know, the union president that was claiming that this was joking around. I mean, it's not like he's given us any reason to give him the benefit of the doubt on this. You know, he's fought reform. He's minimized. Officer-involved violence.
I want to hear from Bill Finkbeiner, but I'm asking, would it be justice to pile, maybe your answer is yes, you know, but to pile those associations that you have with the Seattle Police Department onto a specific charging case when he says, well, this was actually what I was thinking when you heard me laugh. Is it just to judge him otherwise, not take him at his word, but to partly because the associations that you just described, you're probably more likely to think this guy was so callous. If you already thought Seattle police are so callous and arrogant and insulated and, you know, understandably, that's how we judge people. But is that justice? Would that be justice for him to be judged that way when he's disciplined, if he's disciplined?
I think there's two parts to it. I think there's justice, and that's a, you know, a court and the decision to not charge the officer who is driving. Then I think there's a big question about the culture of the Seattle police and the sort of what feels to me on the other side of the lake like a dysfunctional relationship between Seattle and its police department that's getting to the point where the Seattle police culture feels like and maybe it's partly because they feel sort of under threat and antagonized, understandably, after the last few years. But it's getting to the point where it feels like maybe it's a bunker mentality, but it feels like this incident and others that the culture of the Seattle Police Department is really starting to separate from the city. And it doesn't feel like the solution is necessarily, and in this instance, to me, what I heard sounded cavalier and uncaring in the recording that I heard.
To me too.
And so regardless of what's done with this person, what feels to me like is, well, you can punish people or you can fire people to change a culture, and that feels like it needs to happen. And at the same time, Seattle needs to sort of come to grips with, okay, they want a police department. They've decided they're going to have a police department. Now have one that functions well. And this doesn't feel like it's functioning well, and it doesn't feel like Seattle feels represented by their police force. And that's a big deal. I mean, there's, you know, that happens at different times, to different degrees in different cities, but it feels like it's a separation that's, again, it feels like a dysfunctional relationship to me.
And, you know, there's one thing when you catch officers sort of saying things you wouldn't want them to be saying. Okay, don't like that. That's one thing. It's another thing when officers delay, you know, 20 minutes to go to a priority one shooting. It's literally inaction. The Seattle Times story called it lackadaisical. I would call it negligent.
To help listeners out, we're now talking about a different issue of a couple of officers in Soto who were very slow to respond to a priority one report.
Priority one of a person who had been shot, who really was shot and showed up at the hospital shot. And according to the report, three officers, one of whom was in training by one of the senior officers, delayed 20 minutes to get snacks. You know, it's not like they were doing something urgent. And a person could have died. You know, this is beyond sort of nasty talk. This is literally inaction.
Yeah.
It's a serious concern.
And this is what's happening with people that are being trained. Like, this is their introduction to working as a police officer, is having their superiors say that it's okay to stop and get a snack on the way to a priority one shooting.
The trainee was the one who said, yeah, that didn't seem right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, ready to go. Yeah, it feels like there's, you know, significant reason for concern. I think Seattle also needs to find examples of what it does want out of its police and support those and try to find areas where they can say, okay, this is where, you know, we feel like the right thing was happening. And obviously that's happening all the time. It's not, you know, what we hear about and read about, but it feels like the culture there is starting to – especially again, taking 20 minutes to leave over a shooting. I mean, that was shocking to me to read that.
I haven't seen a direct defense of that decision. In the one article I read, I saw that the Office of Police Accountability found that these officers violated professionalism standards, failed in their job to protect the community, that the police chief agreed, but that either, I don't know whether it was up to him specifically or whether he was okay with this was a 9-hour suspension.
Yeah,
a day off without pay.
So,
yeah. But I haven't yet heard that the chief or anyone else directly to explain to us why did that seem like an appropriate punishment. Because there was some reason somebody thought it was appropriate, unless it was just a wink, wink, no one's ever going to hear about this.
I have not heard I don't have an answer to the question you're posing. And the way this broke, I believe, was Divest SPD, which is a Twitter account. So perhaps they didn't, you know, think some random Twitter poster out there, who isn't so random, was going to pick up on this. But they should. They should be well aware that people are watching. I mean, a lot of people are watching.
And I mean, and there has been a huge uptick in citizen journalism about the police department, especially after 2020. And at this point, they should, yes, know very, very, very well that someone is digging through everything that happens in the police department with a fine-tooth comb. And
and my guess is that they do know and they don't care. And that's perhaps more of a concern.
Well, here's one way to look at it. This is the Seattle Times article I read. At least one of the officers said he was relying on his experience. He was sure the victim would be gone when police arrived, which turned out to be the case. I may be conflating the two officers, but at least one officer said that the lights and siren response, quote, heightens my stress level, close quote, and can become a public safety issue for other drivers on the road. Meaning, so what he meant by heightens my stress level could have meant I could be driving recklessly or showing up recklessly, and that can threaten people. And we're just talking about an officer who sped through an intersection and killed somebody. And one of the criticisms I remember when that happened was that he didn't need to be going so fast because, yes, he was responding to an overdose call, but he had also heard on the radio part, or if he was listening, it was a little unclear what he was listening to. He was doing a lot at once. But there was information being relayed that the person who had said, I have overdosed on cocaine, but the person was awake and lucid.
And fine.
However, I think the implication is he should have relied on his better judgment and slowed down. Whereas if someone reports an overdose and they get an emergency call and the cop doesn't slow down, they can understandably be called on the carpet for being lackadaisical about someone who had reported an overdose. So is that fair? A way to look at it? They're using their judgment whether we like it or not.
It feels like being able to drive in a safe manner with your lights on seems like kind of a prerequisite for being a police officer in charge of, especially one in charge of training other police officers.
Yeah.
Also, somebody shot. I mean, there was no question that somebody had been shot and
well, there could have been a false report.
There could have been, but by the time they got there, there was, you know, sort of nothing left to investigate. And you might want to get there quickly to see if there is something to investigate.
I'm not defending them in the individual case. You see what I'm getting at, that we want cops to make the right call.
We do, and I can see how it's very difficult. I mean, as has been talked about, there's a lot of scrutiny right now and a lot of second-guessing whatever police do. And they're human beings and they're going to make mistakes like all of us do. And I can understand how that would be a really difficult work environment to operate in when you feel like you have to make life and death decisions. And then, you know, and then if you make the wrong one anywhere along the line, you're going to get, you know, drugged through the media over it. At the same time, what felt to me when they interviewed those folks and said, why didn't you go there after the shooting was reported? And they said, well, the lights heighten my stress level and lead to, a danger to the public. To me, that felt like a snide comment directed at the people who are against. And there's the bill in the legislature about,
pursuit.
Exactly. Mm. That to me felt like it was a comment on, well, if people don't want me driving fast, then I'm just going to have another, you know, burrito and I'll get there when I get there. And that to me is what feels like the concern. I understand how it is a very difficult job to be a police officer. And I understand how it's even got to be more difficult when you feel like, again, any mistake you make is going to be second guess. But at the same time, it's also a super important job. And if somebody's shot, that should be, to me, feels like it should be a high priority to get there right away. And regardless if you think they're going to be gone or not, to still, if you think it's a credible report that somebody was shot, to to show up quickly. And that is a concern to me when if they're starting, well, you know, whatever, everybody's going to not like what I do anyway. So we'll just sit here for another 10 minutes.
And the police department agreed with that, but it was 1 day suspension.
Yeah.
Right. And I think the snide comment thing really gets back to what we're talking about a fundamental culture problem. And I feel like if they're essentially getting these jobs to help the public, it feels like if there is a concern from the public, the reaction should be, well, let's figure this out. I want to do my job well and not, well, I don't know anything about that. I guess I'll just rebel against it. It seems just very, very backwards about what public safety is supposed to be about.
Yeah. So we're back to that again, that I can't read either the minds of either one of those officers, but I had the same reaction that you all did. It sounded snide. Mm-hmm. It sounded dismissive. In the case of the union rep, it sounded callous. Mm-hmm. And the backdrop is a huge lack of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you were saying, Bill. Like, how are we going to rebuild this?
You got to, because it's a super important job, and you know, it's not an easy fix. It's like a relationship that just feels, I keep saying this, but it feels to me like a dysfunctional relationship where a little bit both sides are like, you know, lost confidence and trust in each other. Yeah, and that's a super important, you know, a role that public safety, it's needed. Yeah. And yeah, it's going to be hard.
All right, we got to take a break. We'll see. New officers are over time on the way. A new city council, new training. We're going to see what's the next gen police department. More of the same, a different kind of officer. Will a different kind of person want to be a Seattle police officer? This is going to be Claudia. Am I allowed to share that you look skeptical?
Oh, you can share anything you want. Yes, okay. Am I making faces? Yes.
Maybe the good news is in that issue where they didn't show up for 20 minutes and they interviewed the three of them, and it was the new person who said,
yes,
boy, that really didn't feel right.
Thank
so
you. That's
maybe
right.
Maybe it is changing.
That's right.
Yes. Thanks for finding the sunny
there you go.
The filament of sunshine in that one.
Well done, Bill Finkbeiner, former state lawmaker, Republican state rep and senator. We have Seattle Times' Claudia Rowe. We have writer-editor Sarah Ann Lloyd. And we're going to take a short break and come back and wrap up This Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke here with Bill Finkbeiner, Claudia Rowe, Sarah Ann Lloyd. A couple stories that we haven't had a chance to mention yet. On the quick side, a cyclist who got attacked by a cougar near Fall City on the trail got released from the hospital, which is good. However, her daughters say that their mom has suffered severe face trauma and permanent nerve damage. She was riding with four other women when the cougar attacked, and the other cyclists wrestled the cougar off of her, pinned it down with a bike.
Yeah.
And this woman who's been released from the hospital, her daughters say their mom is staying positive and hoping to get back on her bike soon. Another story this week is that the food delivery company DoorDash says it's going to go back to Seattle City Hall to try to negotiate changes to the city's new minimum wage for gig workers. This new law requires companies to pay gig workers a minimum wage per minute and per mile. DoorDash imposed a $5 per order fee, it said, quote, to cover costs, and they say customer orders dropped. And that hurts restaurants and DoorDash drivers. The gig workers say don't blame the law for that. Blame the fee, which is retaliatory. Anyway, DoorDash says it's reaching out to the newly elected Seattle City Council in hopes of changing the law. So we'll follow that. And then you should have your presidential primary election ballot now or very soon. The Democratic ballot has Biden, Dean Phillips, and Marianne Williamson, who's not actually a candidate anymore. She's dropped out. Republican ballot has Trump and Haley, who are candidates, and DeSantis, Ramaswamy, and Christie, who are not. And to have your vote counted, this is a special case. You have to identify as either a Republican or a Democrat and then fill out that party's ballot. You're not stuck with that label because other Washington elections don't, and they're not going to ask for your party. But in this case, and you can vote for whoever in the general election, but on this ballot that's in front of you, you have to identify. Does anyone think it's unethical to declare yourself a member of a party that you really don't want to elect and vote for a candidate who you think will cause that party to lose. Is that unethical?
I sure don't think that's unethical. I think the parties have really, you know, overstepped their role in the way they sort of put the public on the hook for these elections. And then in this case, they're going to ignore the outcome as far as designating people to the conventions because they are concerned about exactly what you're talking about. So they're going to elect their delegates through the caucus system. I think it's absolutely ethical to vote for whoever you want to see do the best
And lie about your party affiliation as you're doing it.
You're gonna end up on a lot of mailing lists,
yes.
Which is why they want people to do that.
Good point.
I thought it was weird. You know, up until the early 2000s, there was no party requirements for primaries. You could vote for whoever the heck you wanted, and then the parties basically took it all the way to the Supreme Court and a long time ago got the requirement that you had to designate a party in order to vote in the primaries, and then you could only vote for the people in that party in the mm-hmm. primary, and then Washington Citizens overturned it, I think, rightly.
Anybody else?
I mean, I think it's just one small part of a very large mess that is federal presidential elections, and it's not really something that I think is a large enough problem on the giant pile of problems with federal elections.
Yeah, I don't hear you being in a quandary.
Yes.
Okay. Claudia, you seem okay with it too.
I think there should be more civics education. Okay. That's where I'll leave it.
Let's agree on that. Yeah. Another item this week, a nonprofit law firm that advocates for low-income and marginalized people says that Washington's prison labor system, quote, is nothing short of modern-day slavery. Sarah, you brought this to my attention. What do they mean?
Yeah, so this is actually a nationwide problem, and companies have come under fire for taking advantage of this for a long time. Like Whole Foods uses prison labor to get cheap labor to, like, manufacture cheese. It's a loophole. It's actually a loophole to the 13th Amendment that you can enslave people for punishment. Some states don't even pay prisoners to work. Washington is a state that does pay people to work, but they pay them, you know, anywhere from 50 cents to like $1.50 an hour. It's not, don't quote me on that exact range, but it's...
Some jobs go up to $2.85 per hour, but not all.
Right. And what this report is advocating for is to pay the minimum wage. And one reason that they should be getting minimum wage is because first of all, it's a job. It's a job and you get paid money for a job that you do. And these are jobs that they say are, you know, good for job training, so they should be professionalized. Minimum wage is minimum wage because it's
minimum.
You know,
the legal minimum.
It's the legal minimum. It's the least you can do.
Yeah.
But also being in prison is very, very expensive. There's a monopoly on prison communication, essentially. There's a large corporation that owns a smaller corporation that pretty much controls all prison communications. So if you want a video call, it's going to cost you like $16 an hour. If you want to send an email, that's going to cost you like 30 cents per email. You have to like buy mm-hmm. a stamp booklet. They have some very, very wide discretion about payroll deductions on these checks. They can deduct up to 20% for the cost of incarceration. They have a lot of deductions. None of those deductions are Social Security. So they also can't have those hours count toward actually getting benefits when they get out. It's very hard to have a savings account.
Everything is free. I didn't know that. Like your toothbrush and et cetera.
Yeah, you actually have
nothing is free.
Nothing is free. If you come in there with no money and you need a toothbrush, they add it to your debt to the DOC.
Yeah.
Yeah. You get penalized if you do not work.
Yeah.
So if you want to focus on your studies or something like that, you can get additional time for refusing to work.
Yeah. I can't understand the argument. You were nodding as well, Bill, former Republican lawmaker. If it's the minimum wage and you're doing a job, how does having been convicted rightly or wrongly convicted of a crime change the fact that you get minimum wage for working?
Well, I separate the two issues a little bit. Number one, I think that there are too many instances where we've sort of, by privatizing prisons, we've sort of added costs and expenses. I think that you should, there shouldn't be, your basic needs should be met in prison, and that should be a no cost. And so I don't think people should be forced to work while they're in prison. That said, if they choose to work, I don't see that they should be required to have a minimum wage. They're in prison. I think that just the cost of the bill that I saw was almost $100 million. I feel like
but the fact that it's expensive is
– it shouldn't be expensive. I think that's the fix to me is not to give minimum wage $20 an hour to people working in prison. The fix to me is to not charge for a toothbrush. And I think there was like a certain number of emails or video calls that you could do per month without paying. But it shouldn't cost you money to be in prison. And you shouldn't walk out of prison with a debt to just have existed.
Okay.
That said, I don't think that that it should be. I think if you want to work, there's a lot of benefits that prisoners can get from working. But to me, it doesn't feel like somebody who's in prison has been convicted of a pretty significant wrongdoing, and I think if they want to work, they should be able to. They should not, in any case, ever be forced to work, is the distinction that I make.
I still don't get the logical trigger. I know it's expensive, and we don't like when the people commit crimes, people who at least they've been convicted. I still don't know why that changes the equation, that this is the statement, you're working, there's a minimum wage, and whether it's expensive for the state to incarcerate people or not, it's the minimum wage. But what else? Anything to add? Did we pretty much cover this story?
I mean, part of the one thing that the report raises that's really, really interesting is they scale up. So they have one commissary. That's all. They have a captive customer base, essentially. So there's no competition in the prison commissary market. And one thing the report does is it scales up like the typical prison wage to the minimum wage and what the equivalent for the cost of that food would be. And for a 24-pack of chicken ramen, a prisoner saving up to get that ramen is the equivalent of somebody making minimum wage paying $130 for a 24-pack of ramen.
Oh. Okay, this is where I have to watch the clock and say we've got 4 minutes left in the show. I wanted to hear what made anybody smile this week. Also, you told me something I didn't know, Bill Finkbeiner, that the Mariners, who are in spring training, have this slogan I've never heard of, and they haven't changed it. They haven't been getting to the World Series, but they haven't changed their slogan in the last few years.
Hey, I don't think it's the slogan's fault. I thought the title of the article was kind of funny. It said, Service said, hey, this is the hungriest team we've ever had. I thought, oh, is that because the management shut down the food service for this
commissary?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. No, I actually think this Mariners team is going to be a fun one to watch this year. I think they've got a lot going on. I think it's going to be a very interesting team. They've got the components that put together. I think their hitting is going to be a little bit stronger, but there's a lot of question marks in it too. At the same time, and
so like every year,
yeah. Well, this one more maybe than most. Oh, okay. Definitely. Expectations are lower this year than they have been last year, which is maybe a hard thing coming in, but hopefully it'll pay off through this season.
Okay, so if you're curious, the slogan is "Doesn't matter, get better."
Get better, yeah.
So I'm a player. You're the manager, Skipper. I wish we had better players on this team. What's your response? What's your four-word response?
Yeah,
well,
Service's response is "Doesn't matter, get better."
Yeah. And Skipper, my ankle really hurts when I walk. I think it might be broken. Do you have to say to me?
I think this is a team that takes that to heart. I think this is going to be an exciting team, and I think they're going to be. They want to compete, and they've got the pieces. If things fall into place.
Yeah,
to really put it together. So
if they fall into place, they will have fallen into place.
It's all, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of ifs, but it could happen.
Okay, 2 minutes left. Who smiled this week about something that our listeners can benefit from?
I saw a photograph of a duckling riding on a floating piece of pizza,
What?
Yeah. You can probably Google it. It'll probably. I think you can Google like blessed boat and it will come up.
But. And it's okay if it eats the pizza because it is a duck. It's not, right. You know, you're not terrified about what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
It can, eat it, it can have its cake. It can have its pizza and
float on it too.
Yeah.
My reason to smile is in the sort of dark news about media lately, nationally and everywhere, you know, with layoffs happening everywhere and the Washington, D.C. NPR station just laid off 15
yep.
people yesterday.
Yep.
I feel like in Seattle, media takes a lot of swings at each other. And I say, great, I'm glad we have a media ecosystem that is large enough that can sustain that.
Mm.
I kind of feel, you know, I used to get sort of bristly when people criticized the Seattle Times or wherever I was working. But now I think, great, you know, like we have enough media outlets that we can do that food fight. So great.
Wait, I've got critics. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I still
people
exist.
People listening.
Yeah.
Yes. Bill Finkbeiner, anything?
Yeah. Well, it was an announcement last week that light rail is going to open up on the east side April 27th, which is kind of a big deal. Something that people don't know maybe as much about is the East Rail, which is a 42-mile bike trail that runs sort of north-south, is also opening up from Bellevue all the way to Woodinville at the same time. So this coming summer, you'll be able to go from Bellevue to Woodinville, walking, biking, and then in a couple of years, get all the way across Lake Washington and into Seattle, which will be nice.
Yeah, someday. All right, I'll add mine. The Coast Guard is alerting ships and the sailors that they might hit a whale. And the thing is, we didn't used to know so much about where the whales were. Now you've got apps. You can find a whale, report a whale. We've got underwater microphones. They're testing thermal cameras to spot whales at night. And this whale report alert system says it's sending about 100 alerts a week just in Puget Sound right now. I can hear the whale behind in the background. See that? And I wanted to know, do pilots want to know all this information, constantly being told, well, you better swerve, you better slow down. So I asked the person who runs the whale trail, and her name is Donna Sandstrom. I said, is there going to be a backlash? And she said, no, the big boat operators are being very cooperative. Nobody wants to hit a whale. So if you want to report a whale sighting, download an app called Whale Alert. And you can see where other people are alerting as well. Let's hear. Can we hear from that whale a little bit, Bernard?
Is that a whale?
Hear that? I think so. That is Bernard Whalette.
Is that a Bernard or is
running
that a whale?
The board. Thank you to Bernard. Thank you to our producer, Kevin Kniestat. Seattle Times, Claudia Rowe. Writer-editor, Sarah Ann Lloyd. Former state representative and senator, Republican Bill Finkbeiner. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for being the show.
Thanks for having us,
Bill.
I would say it a whale if I could. Join us again next week.